Good evening, and welcome live from the Downtown Activity Center, and we are live. It's the Core of the Matter. I'm Steve Corey here, your host and servant for the next hour. This evening's topic, you might find it interesting, space, flying, the Avro Arrow, how government uses science. Well, we might get into that a little bit. You're hearing us on Voice of the Shuswap, 93.7 FM, CKVS, in Salmon Arm. And we also stream live on the net at voiceoftheshuswap.ca. And as you know, the Core of the Matter is a current affairs talk radio interview discussion to enlighten and inform and even entertain, we hope. And I want to introduce to you my guest in just a moment, but I will give you his name. If I tried to give you a fair summary of his CV, it would take a good part of this program just to go through it. So I'm going to go through it, and we're going to touch on some of it. But his name is Bruce Aikenhead, and he has lived a very full life. And I'm just going to touch on some of the highlights of his CV. He began in 1941 by taking the radio fundamentals and servicing in Hamilton, Ontario. That's 1941. That's when he started. And I believe at the time he was
17.
I should welcome you, Bruce, give you an opportunity. 17 years old. How are you?
I'm 90.
90 now. Yep. 90 years old and still going strong. I met Bruce for the first time at the at the jazz club. They had what night was that when we first met?
It'd be a Thursday night, probably.
It was a Thursday night, but
a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I can't remember who was playing. If it was the night of the Gypsy Jazz, I think it was.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, so you started Radio Fundamentals. You were 17 years old, and then in 1941, you were a radar mechanic at RCAF and the RAF in Britain and India. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. What were you working on in India? Radar in India also?
Well, it came to be known later as radar.
But yeah.
At that time, it was called RDF, and the letters were secret. People would say, oh, that means radio direction finding, and we were to smile an inscrutable smile.
Yeah, radio direction finding. Yeah, automatic direction finding. We had those in air traffic control, automatic direction finding. Anyway, so that was the war years, and then after the war in 1945, you were a student in physics and mathematics at the University of Western Ontario. So, and I believe you told me that that's where you got married when you were going to university.
Yeah, that was my hometown.
Oh.
And my girlfriend and I, whom I met in Toronto, decided that London was the place, and we got married.
Wow. And yeah, I understand it lasted for many, many years, and my congratulations. And then from 1950 to 55... you were a radio and television receiver engineer with, they called it at the time, Dominion Electrohome in Kitchener?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dominion Electrohome. So that's the same company as the Electrohome of today?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We could. That's an then, from 1950, I've got to keep these numbers correct here, that was to 55. Yeah. 55 to 58, so a space of about 3 years, you were working on the CF-100, which was also called the Canuck, Flight Simulator Systems Engineer, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And you were in...
Well, what had happened after being in at Electrohome for about 5 years, I began to think that perhaps I'm in a rut. So I inquired of one of my classmates who was with the CAE, Canadian Aviation Electronics, in Montreal, to get his opinion as to whether I should bite the bullet and head to the States or maybe there was something in Canada. And with that, he said, why don't you come here? We work on flight simulators. And that sounded pretty good, so away I went. And my wife and I moved to Montreal. And I was there for, as you can see from my chart, until... I learned about the Avro Arrow that was taking place in Toronto. But well, anyway, okay. I'm interrupting. You go ahead.
No. Hey, you're the guest. You always have the opportunity to talk, Bruce. But from 55 to 58, 3 years you were working on the CF-100. And for those out there, for those of you who don't know what the CF-100, it was, they called it the Canuck. It was a two-engine jet interceptor. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty well, maybe not ahead of its time, but it was definitely, at the time, was avant-garde or leading edge.
Yep.
The CF-100, yep. It two engine or two passenger. Also, they had a navigator, radar operator in the back. But now let's get to the Avro Arrow. In 1958-59, you worked on the simulator systems engineer at the AV Row. So you went back to Toronto.
It really wasn't going back to Toronto. This was the first time to...
Oh, that's right. Okay, sorry.
And what had happened, I'd heard about the Arrow, and lo and behold, they were looking for somebody to work on their flight simulator. And so I put in my name and was hired. And the nice thing about it was that this was a different kind of a simulator. The ones simulators I'd worked on previously had been for training pilots. This one was a research tool. The pilot was already the test pilot, and the simulator was for the purpose of rehearsing a test flight and also for comparing the performance of the airplane with the performance of the simulator and trying to decide which was right. Was the airplane misbehaving, or was there something the matter with the simulator?
So it wasn't strictly to train pilots.
No, not at all.
Because most of the simulators that I was familiar with either were for training pilots or air traffic controllers.
No,
so that's interesting.
This was a research tool, and it was absolutely fascinating, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. But then, as you know, the program was abruptly terminated.
That's what I... Before we get to the termination part, because I have some questions concerning that, but the Avro Arrow, and in fact, I was telling you I have a print at home, a nice, beautiful, it's a painting, but it's just a print that I got of the Arrow in flight. I think it was... number one or two. A beautiful airplane. In fact, I was just looking at... I was on the computer today, and I noticed, I think it was the Phantom that looks a lot like the Arrow. I think it was a Phantom.
Well, it was one of the early Delta
wings.
It was in many respects ahead of its time, but strangely enough, it was the program was canceled because the threat no longer existed at the altitudes for which the airplane had been designed.
That's what they thought.
Yeah.
Didn't they end up buying another interceptor, the Voodoo?
No. They switched to guided missiles.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a different story.
Yeah, but they had the Voodoo right up into. When I was working in Quebec City. Yeah. They had the Voodoo, the CF-101, they called it.
Oh, yes.
The McDonnell Douglas, I think it was MD, the Voodoo. Anyway, so they canceled the Avro Arrow because you said that, the day of the interceptor was over. I agree. That's one of the stories that I heard was that, I forget who the president of the United States was, but they had convinced Canada, the interceptor's, that's finished. Now let's... we're going to get into some missiles, right? And I think, wasn't that the time of the Bomark?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That was to be the replacement.
Up for the Avro Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
So you were working on the simulator. Now, off air you were telling me they, instead of just one or two prototypes or one prototype, they actually produced about four of them?
Yes.
About four airplanes.
Yeah. The idea was that if you were doing testing of a new airplane design and you only had one airplane, it was going to take a lot longer than if you had several. So they could run these test flights in parallel. That was the rationale for having more than one Avro Arrow. But the the cancellation took place, and many books have been written about why. It was as much for political purposes as anything else that the system was shut down.
But why would they? Why would they not only shut it down? That's one thing, But why did they actually physically destroy every one of the prototype, every one of the airplanes that they built? You can't even get. I know that there is a cockpit somewhere. I forget. I think it's in the Aviation Museum in Ottawa.
Yeah, and that was
peak.
I was trying to look for a polite word to say, but
lunacy.
It was just people being bitter and saying, you know, it was a terrible mistake to build it in the first place. Get rid of all that junk. And that's what somebody did.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you're listening to CKVS 93.7 FM. Voice of the Shuswap here in Salmon Arm. We're live from the Downtown Activity Center this evening, Tuesday. If you're listening on Sunday, then you're hearing a rebroadcast on Sunday at 11 o'clock of this program. I'm talking to Bruce Aikenhead. Now, Bruce has had a long and very distinguished, when I read off some of the things on this CV here, a distinguished career in aviation and space exploration. We're only at 1958-59 in the Avro Arrow. I knew this would happen, but we will have to move on. I mean, the Avro Arrow is still to this day, from what I can gather, quite a controversy. Would you agree?
It's history.
yeah. So anyway, when it was canceled, one of the things I heard was that I read this somewhere. I think that we lost something like 14,000. Technicians, aero engine techs, and
well, there were about 14,000 workers, it was a real blow to the community.
Yeah, I can just imagine the whole country. It would have been a blow to the whole country.
Yeah.
So from there, you went to work in the Mercury astronaut training. As a project engineer in 1959 what was it called?
It was a remarkable coincidence. In the States, the research organization that had been developed shortly after the time of the Wright brothers, with the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, had been given a new name, a new job. And the new name was the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
NASA.
Pronounced NASA.
Yeah.
And their new job was to see if they could have a man in a small spacecraft launched by a rocket function usefully in space. And they were fairly confident, and they'd gone out and hired 7 test pilots who were willing to give it a try, and they had a company in St. Louis, a McDonnell Company, design and build a small spacecraft. In fact, they built several of them, and these were to be launched by an Atlas rocket and put into space, put into orbit around the Earth. And so the idea was to train these fellows do the tasks that were expected of them, so they could be evaluated as whether it was, there really was a useful role for people flying in space. The Russians had apparently done a little bit. They put Yuri Gagarin into orbit, and now the United States wanted to give it a try. So they were looking for people to put a man on the nose of something that everybody knew was going to blow up in the launch pad, and they couldn't get anybody to work on a dumb thing like that. And somebody said, well, why don't you go up to Toronto? There's a whole bunch of people just got laid off from the cancellation of a big airplane project. And the result was that about 30 of us Avro guys, guys, went down to
Langley Field.
Langley Field. Which was across the river from Norfolk, Virginia. It was really quite fascinating work there. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was assigned to the job of developing a training equipment because of my familiarity with flight simulators. And it was really very enjoyable, fascinating work, a great bunch to work with. And then we got a new boss named Lyndon Johnson, who said that we were all to move to Houston and become Texans. And quite a few of the Americans said, no way, and quite a few of the Canadians said, I think I'll go home. And so my wife and I and the kids moved back to Canada and settled in Montreal. We put together a system for getting weather photos that, from satellites that had been designed to take photographs of the earth below and the cloud patterns and so forth. And it was a great way of being able to see the weather systems as they moved from east to west or west to east, whatever. This was something that could be done by radio amateurs as well as commercial systems. Anyway, it was something that CAA thought that they ought to have a go at it because it suggested to the world that CAA was getting into the space business. Anyway, I did that for a while, and then one of the other Avro people who had come back to Canada after the cancellation, after the decision that NASA had made that we should move to Texas, he had come back and was working on another degree at McGill. He used to visit us from time to time and told us that one day that down at McGill there was a genius who was doing some very clever research using guns to launch projectiles to very, very high altitudes. And this was the famous Gerald Bull. And he did indeed have battleship guns assembled in such a way that the length of the barrel was over 100 feet, pointed straight up, and he was able to send projectiles to 100 miles straight up.
100 miles straight up.
And was able to get a lot of very interesting work done that at those altitudes that had not been done previously. And in fact, his work showed that there was a thing that later came to be known as the jet stream. This fellow said, why don't you come down and talk to Jerry? You'll find him very interesting. I went down and had a visit and came back telling my wife I had decided that this was where I wanted to work.
And, next thing you know, you're working for...
So I was working for Jerry Bull. And what he had in mind was that he was going to be able to gun launch projectiles, and his studies indicated that he'd be able to use the guns to launch a two-stage rocket that would have enough speed and capacity to be able to put a small object into orbit.
Yeah.
And would I like to do that? And so I said, yeah, sounds like a great idea.
Well, here's where our career paths sort of, they crossed. I never knew you, but I did know about Jerry Bull because when I was an air traffic controller in Montreal, I was telling you this off air, we had a restricted airspace just south of Montreal, fairly long, right along the border.
Yeah.
And it was unlimited, I remember. Yeah. You know, you just don't go near it because when they're launching one of these things, you can't go over it because he's going 100 miles into space. I remember it. Yeah, I forget the name of it. There was a name for
high water.
High water.
Yep.
The high water range. When they activated it, we just kept our traffic away from it, mm-hmm, on radar. But hey, listen, just for a moment, if you don't mind, I want to go back just for a second to the Arrow and that Arenda engine. Now, they never did get the Arenda into the Arrow, did they?
There was a later Arenda engine that they were not able to get in. With the engines that they already had, they flew at Mach 1.98. If they'd had the new engine, it would have been in excess of Mach 2.
Yeah, because I remember, again, in some of the stuff that I read, and it hasn't been recently, I should have got into it again, that USAF, the United States Air Force, was flying that Arenda engine around on their B-57. They had a test.
No, that was a deal. In order to do some of the testing, the development of their, they were able to make use of one of those airplanes, and the test engine was bolted onto the side of the aircraft just below the tail surface. They were able to crank it up. They didn't put it at full thrust because it would have been pretty hard on the other. But they were able to run performance tests at high altitudes, which you couldn't do on the ground.
Yeah. I heard some interesting stories because those guys, when they cranked up the throttle, not to full throttle, but when they cranked it up, they couldn't believe the thrust of this thing. And they went back to their people in the Pentagon and said, you better go up there and check out those Canucks because they're working on something, and I'll tell you what it is, but it's pretty powerful. Pretty powerful stuff. Yeah, the Arrow is, I could do a whole program. There's another gentleman here in Salmon Arm who worked, lost his name for the moment. Who worked on the Arrow? I think he was working on some of the weapons that were going to go. Some of the armament for the Arrow. But getting back to HAARP, the High Altitude
Research Project.
Yeah, this gun launch. Jerry Bolt. Now, for those who are not familiar, Bruce and I were talking about this. Actually, there was some cloak and dagger business that went on. Jerry Bull lost his funding at some point.
Yeah, what happened was that our HAARP program was a joint program with the U.S., and at one point they said, sorry, fellas, but we've got to go and get involved in this Vietnam thing, so goodbye. The Canadian side said, well, if they're pulling out, so are we. I went to work in the morning and learned all this, and by noon I was out of work. But quite fortunately, I ran into somebody who said, why don't you go over to RCA? They're trying to find another engineer to work on a satellite job. So I had a new job in the afternoon.
Yeah, you were really lucky. But getting back to Jerry Bull again, Gerald Bull and the HAARP project, when he lost his funding from Canada and the United States, he then went searching for other funding, and he ended up going to, was it Iraq, I think?
It was a kind of a long section in between. He spent some time in jail, in the penitentiary in the States, for selling projectiles to South Africa and without a license, transporting them from Canada through the States to a place where they were put on board a ship out in U.S. waters. Anyway, he was violating umpteen regulations, and so he spent 6 or 8 months in jail in the States, came out very, very bitter, and headed to Belgium, which was the heart of the arms industry.
Yeah.
And it was there he was introduced to somebody who said, I want you to build a big gun for me.
Yeah. And then he was eventually, I guess, anyway, thank you for the detail, but eventually he ended up working with Saddam Hussein, I believe, in Iraq.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think he was still working on this long-range gun.
They was just at the talking phase.
Oh, okay.
But the word got out.
Yeah, word got out. And I remember, I'm trying to think which magazine it was that I read about the cloak and dagger part of this, because everybody believes it was the Israeli Mossad who went and they warned him. They warned him a couple of times. He was living in Belgium, or was it in Holland?
Belgium.
And they went to his apartment, and they actually moved a few things or something, as I recall. Anyway, they wanted to warn him, but he never took it, and finally he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess the Israelis were sort of really concerned, because if Saddam had have developed this gun, he would have been able to, would he have been able to reach Israel, I suppose.
Yeah.
And at the time they were. Anyway, that's another story. And here we are. Time is just flying by, and I barely got through half of your CV because I want to get down to some of the parts that since you retired. But anyway, we're now. It's now 67 to 71. It's called the ISIS, the Ionosphere Research Satellite.
Yeah. Well, as part of a group, LISIS was an acronym for International Satellites for Ionospheric Studies.
Okay.
There had already been an ISIS-1, and now they needed an engineer to work on ISIS-2. And it just happened that I was available, having been laid off with the gun cancellation. So I got that job in the afternoon. I got fired in the morning from McGill and was able to start in the afternoon. I worked on the ISIS program for that was about 4 years altogether that it took to there's a whole crew of us that were doing the that work. Our client was the Communications Research Center in Ottawa, they were very pleased with the performance of ISIS-1 and ISIS-2. Finally, in 1971, said that they would like us to move to Ottawa and put together a new satellite that would be used to broadcast to people at very high frequencies so that you didn't have to put up a great big dish or any kind of a difficult antenna. Just a tiny little pie plate size thing would do for the kind of communications they were talking about. And this became the kind of communication satellite that everyone knows these days. In fact, nowadays we don't even have to use it. We get things over the cable.
Yeah, but still, yeah. And a couple of points here. You, when you first started with RCA on the ISIS project, you were 39 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, after reading all this, your rather colorful career leading up to that, I would have thought, well, this guy probably be in his 50s, 39. Yeah. Did you have any children at that time? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. We had... at that time, I guess we had three.
Three children.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now you're moved. Now you're moved to Ottawa with the RCA.
That was in Montreal. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the new satellite wasn't with RCA?
No. Our client was in Ottawa, but RCA was working out of Montreal.
Oh, okay.
And on the next project, the client, Communications Research Center in Ottawa, said they would like to get the same crew that had worked on the earlier satellite to move up to Ottawa and work on the design up there.
Okay.
So I moved up, that worked out very, very well. They were quite pleased. We finally had done everything we were expected to do, and we were on the point of heading back to Montreal. In fact, some of the guys had already gone. I got a phone call from somebody who said, look, it seems that the Americans have decided that there is... I'm trying to think of the sequence of things. Anyway, the Americans had gone ahead with the design of a thing called the space shuttle.
Yep.
The space shuttle was getting things, components made for it from a variety of sources, and now they were down to a choice. Would Canada like to build the toilet or the thing called a mechanical arm? Fortunately, the decision was made that we would build the mechanical arm to go on board the space shuttle, the Canadian contractor would do the work. And this was Spar Aerospace in Toronto.
Oh.
And National Research Council was given the job of monitoring what the Canadian contractor was going to be doing. I was luckily chosen to be one of the crew that was to monitor on behalf of the National Research Council the work that the Canadian contractor was doing. This was a tough project, and it went on for about 5 years. But NASA was very, very pleased with the Canadarm and its performance.
The Canadarm.
Yeah. Of course, we were doing our work out of Ottawa, but it involved frequent trips down to Toronto. I probably was down in Toronto a couple of days a week throughout all that period of time. And
how did you get to Toronto, just out of curiosity? Did you fly or did you ever take the train?
Both.
Yeah.
Mostly by flying.
Yeah. Yeah, I was, in 1970, in those years I was in Montreal, I guess, so I wasn't, there was a neat little shuttle service between Montreal and Ottawa called Air Transit,
No, I don't think I
It went into Rockcliffe. Mm-hmm. They were flying out of the Victoria parking lot in Montreal and Rockcliffe, and they were using Twin Otters.
Oh, yes. Yep.
And it was really avant-garde because they were using these pre-determined, they were what we called profiles. They were flying profiles. Mm. Time, altitude, place. They be a certain place at a certain altitude, a certain time.
Yep.
So the controllers were using that. That's how we used some of our separation was based on that guy's going to be at a certain altitude over there. Mm-hmm. We'll either top him or go under, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, we got to get, I'm amazed at how quickly the time flies when we're having fun. So we've got you back in Ottawa. You're working on the Canadarm project for Spar Aerospace, but you are working, actually you're working for the NRC,
Council. Yeah. That worked out very well. NASA was very pleased with the performance of it, they said that it would make everybody happy if we could now provide some people who would fly on board the space shuttle as a sort of a token gesture.
Yeah.
But the National Research Council or whoever it was. Said, I think what we're going to do is hire some astronauts. We're going to recruit some. And put ad in the paper, and they recruited six astronauts. And it took, a lengthy procedure. But anyway, they recruited the six astronauts, and I had been... tidying up after all the Canadarm people had moved out, and they said, you've got some office space there now, and the result was that I had six new astronauts to accommodate. Roberto Bondar and Mark Garneau were put into one office, and I put Steve McLean and Bob Thirsk in the next office, Ken Money and Bjarne Tryggveson in the next office. What had happened was that we had been invited to have people fly on the space shuttle, and these people had been hired because there were two schools of thought. One said we needed to have people with life sciences backgrounds, people with medical backgrounds who could deal with the apparent problems that people had of becoming used to weightlessness and problems like that. And the other school of thought said, no, take it for granted that people will be able to do that. What we want to do now is make use of weightlessness and being up above the atmosphere and so on. So that's why we had these two types of astronaut. Anyway, fast forward to a few years later, it was apparent that there was going to be a space station, and that we were almost certainly being invited to have Canadians as part of the crew. And the astronauts that we had hired some years ago were getting a bit long in the tooth, so we should get some new astronauts. And the result was that we again put an ad in the paper, and this time we were able to limit it to four astronauts that we recruited. And this was the ones that we chose were Julie Payette and Steve.
Oh, listen, if you can't remember their names, you haven't got them written down.
No. Julie Payette, Chris Hadfield.
Oh, that's a name we know.
Yeah, and Dave Williams, and another fella who, as it turned out, had thought that he'd be able to do this astronaut thing on a part-time basis. He was really based in Calgary, and that's where he had a research program going, and he thought he'd be able to do both jobs on a part-time basis. And he withdrew after 2 weeks, so that's why I can't remember his name.
Okay, but I noticed the name Chris Hadfield. So now, in 1990, I see that you are now 1990, yep, you're 53 years old. And by this time, there's an error there. You're 63.
Yeah.
And from 1990 to 93, you're Director General of the Astronaut Program for the Canadian Space Agency.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is when you hired these four other astronauts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then finally in 1993, at the age, it says here anyway, 69, you retired and moved to
Salmon Arm.
To Salmon Arm in 1993. And I asked you off air, and it bears repeating, there's a family connection here.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons that you were attracted.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But it's a kind of a neat place.
Yeah. One of my daughters lives in Coldstream.
Ah, okay. Just outside, a suburb of Vernon.
Yeah.
So you retired. And
her husband spent summer holidays in Salmon Arm.
Okay, there's the connection. And then in 1997, you became a curator of the Space and Astronomy section of the Okanagan Science Center.
Well, yeah, so that was a voluntary thing. I did that for about 10 years.
Yeah. So now, in 1997, I see here you were appointed an officer of the Order of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations. It's been, believe me, I can't believe the time. I'm looking at the time. I've got about 1 minute left, and really, I have to tie it up. I have to end it. But I'm honored to have the opportunity to talk to you, Bruce. You've had a very colorful career.
Yeah. I'm honored to have been invited.
Well, it's our pleasure, believe me, and I'm sure that there are many people out there, and I hope that they have enjoyed this. You're listening to CKVS 93.7, Voice of the Shuswap. My guest this evening has been Bruce Aikenhead, with a long, distinguished career in the aviation industry, starting in 1941. Thank you very much for coming, Bruce.
Well, thank you for having me.